I'd date her, but, you know, just to get to Ryan.
Yeah, I kind of have a man crush on Ryan Reynolds.
Yeah.
Something about that guy. He's endearing as all get up.
All right. So, you want to go?
Yeah.
Yeah, because you got to go.
This is exciting. I'm on an actual microphone this time.
I know. Back in your castle, princess.
Yes. Thank you.
So, it's what is the date today? June 27th.
Yep.
3 days before mom's birthday.
Aw.
Yeah. So, it is Tuesday, June 27th, and today is it is the best day of the week, really.
Tuesday. Yes. Tuesday.
Yeah. And not just for tacos, but that.
You know, there's a place in my neighborhood that does pretty good burgers, and I went in there the other day and it said half price burgers on Tuesday. And do you follow those sorts of things when
local
places have deals?
Why not save money on some good food? If it's good food.
Yeah.
I mean, I won't go someplace just because it's, you know, a dollar taco day or something, but if it's good, sure.
Yeah, I reminded myself, you know what, I should come here on Tuesday and get a burger.
So. Yeah. There's a little Mexican place. It's not even a place. It's an Airstream trailer that they have converted to, you know, like a food truck type thing.
Sure, always the best.
That's parked in front of this
your house?
Auto repair. Yeah, I'm in front of my house. It's mine, actually. I just bought it. I haven't tried it yet because it's only been there for about a week, but I drove by there the other day at lunchtime and there was quite the line. So might be pretty tasty. Yeah. Anyway, let's jump into this, tell them who we are and then we can go back. It's on Taco Tuesday is what it is. Your spicy, I don't know. It's on Taking Pictures, episode 270. Is the number for those of you who have been listening since episode one. I wonder how many people have never missed and have listened since episode one.
Ooh, I don't know. If you have,
if that is you, yeah, call in. Right in. Call in 347-687-9411. Or send us an email at I just blanked. What's our email address?
Podcast on taking pictures.
Right.
Let us know how your divorce went. what job you had before you started listening.
Right. So Jeffrey Sidoris in Silver String. Bill, now back on the East Coast in Brooklyn, no longer
flying around
waiting
the world
for a special phone call on the white phone.
reunited, and it feels so good. Yeah,
it does.
It's good.
Yeah.
I like being home. Yeah.
Do you want to continue our discussion around the Chris's and the Ryans, or should we jump into photography?
I'm going to stick with Ryan Reynolds in Van Wilder. He makes that movie.
Okay.
That's where I kind of fell for Ryan Reynolds.
Yeah. Gosling in The Notebook. You can't go wrong there.
Oh God. Yeah. You can't. Yeah. You know, he's like he's the quintessential manly man in that movie. Right. He's the man every man really wants to be. That's sort of the origin of the Hey Girl meme.
Right. Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
Like I'm good looking and I'm sweet and I'm strong and you know,
and I'm handy around a woodshop.
Yes. Right.
So
isn't that his whole thing?
Sure.
Okay. Moving on. how was your week? You good?
Good. Yeah, good. We're proofing the book. Very excited about that, getting that beast out into the world.
Yeah.
And if you'll grant me some leeway, friend of the show, Carl Taylor.
Yeah.
I've been working with Carl on a new project that's been super secret. And now it is out in the light of day. If you've listened to this show, you've heard us talk about Carl Taylor. We dig Carl. And, you know, I think both of us agree that he is, if not the best, he's one of the best out there when it comes to photography education.
Yeah, he's very good.
So Carl has launched a new project called CarlTaylorEducation.com. And it's It's everything. It's all of his previous courses, all of his future courses. They're doing live shows now. They're doing competitions. They've got partner discounts. You get everything, $14 a month.
Ah, I see. A little bit of a Creative Live competitor in some ways.
Absolutely. Except that you don't have to watch 7 hours worth of video to get to the meat of what you're there for.
Sure. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So go check it out, carltaylereducation.com.
We should be clear that this is not an official ad. We just know and like Carl.
Yeah, we just know Carl and think Carl is a pretty cool guy. So go check it out.
Yep. Very cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I saw a thing on the social media the other day, but I didn't get a chance to check it out. Man, they got some serious production stuff going on in this thing.
They have got serious. I mean, look, his studio. Have you seen this studio?
Yeah, it's the size of my house, your house, and 10 other houses.
It's like 5,000 square feet or 4,000 square feet or something. It's giant.
Yeah.
So, yeah, cool stuff.
Apparently, you and I got to move to Guernsey.
That's where all the stuff's happening. That's,
apparently, that's
you know,
where you can get 5,000 square feet of studio space.
Right.
Yeah. very cool. Yeah. We'll have to check that out.
Yep.
So last time,
previously on
back
On Taking
in the
Pictures.
Hall of Justice. Yeah.
All right.
It's kind of sad with Adam West going, isn't it?
It is.
Making that sound and doing the
my. I have some very good friends, the Jankiewicz brothers, Pat and Don.
You've mentioned them before.
Who were at the lighting, the Batman lighting
of course, yeah.
On City Hall in downtown LA. Excuse me, City Hall.
It you know the whole thing where you the lifting up the head of the statue to hit the button to open the door to go down the poles?
Yeah.
I mean that is really deeply ingrained in my head.
Sure.
I mean, that is like, oh, I want to do that someday when I grow up kind of stuff. You know what
yeah.
I mean?
Well, and, you know, it was, sure, it was a kitsch show, but it became part of, for those of us who grew up around that time, it became part of our sort of collective unconscious.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. And you know? there's an entire Instagram of Batman signs. Like, you know,
oh,
the
really?
Weird... Yeah, you know, like the weird labels they had all over
sure.
the place on that show?
Yeah.
There's a guy, I'll find it and put it in the show notes. Batman 66 Labels. Yeah, it's batlabels.com or batlabels on Instagram. And it's just, I think this
oh,
is
I've
the one.
I've got to look at this.
Wait, is this, this might not be the one. It might be a slightly different one. But it's one of these, yeah. And all it is basically, you know, little things of Batman, like the weird little signs and things from Batman, which just kind of cracks me up. You know, the weird labels, roving robot reorderer,
right.
Catwoman's amazing maze, portable robot retriever, you know.
Somebody posted the clip where, like, it's a bad day to get rid of a bomb.
Yeah.
And it goes on for like 15 minutes of Batman trying to get rid of this basically cartoon bomb, you know, the sphere with the looks like a flare stuck in the top of it.
Yeah. Yeah, there's like a picture here of a bunch of guys like in bowler hats and black shirts that say goon on the front.
Right.
You know? Come on.
Just so you know, just in case you're not clear on which team they're playing for.
Yeah, they're just mislabeled bad guys. They're just bad guys with labels, you know.
Yeah.
Just really funny. So we were talking about this idea, and it seems like we struck a chord because a few people commented on the group on
right.
the I don't know if you noticed that.
Yep, I did.
About this whole idea of inherited meaning, right? Because we were talking about what was the guy's name again? Just so I get it right, Gold, Ed Gold, right?
Mm-hmm.
That Ed Gold was out shooting.
For years on some of these things.
Oh no! You know what it was? It was the blues guy.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. The tintypes shooting the blues musicians.
Right.
Yep.
And we said that made sense because the medium fit the message.
Sure.
In some
sure.
ways. And therefore it was more quote unquote okay than just shooting tintypes for the sake of shooting tintypes.
Mm-hmm.
And a bunch of people wrote in saying we're crazy and agreeing with us and disagreeing with us and saying, why is that different than an Instagram filter? And you know, all that kind of stuff. It's interesting.
Well, do you want to tackle that, like that particular question first?
Yeah.
Why is that different?
I think because it's hard to do.
Yeah, it speaks to craft.
Yeah. It's it takes a lot of time to learn how to do this stuff. And I think that there's something valuable. It's evidence of work. The fact that somebody figured out how to do something.
Mm-hmm. Effort.
It's evidence of effort. And there's something inherent, or at least for you and I think, in showing that it took a long time to do this, you know. I sculpted this thing, you know, with a chainsaw. Well, that's one thing. I sculpted this thing with only sandpaper over the course of 16 years.
Right.
Well, I mean, it's not necessarily makes it better, but it sort of makes you, wow, you really invested something into this, you know?
Sure.
And so I think that the difference between somebody learning how to do tintype well enough to go shoot these people and somebody just pressing a button on Instagram, I think that is the difference, at least for me. Would you go any further than that?
Well, I think you hit it, but it's, you know, tintype is a great example because you've only got a few minutes to develop that shot that you just made.
Yeah.
So you've got to take your darkroom with you. That's the other the component to that is, and yes, you're dealing with hazardous chemicals. Yes, you're dealing with time sensitive processes. Yes, you're dealing with a degree of randomness in the output of the work that most of us don't run across too often.
Sure. I think so that there's also a thing, Jeffrey, where because that medium is a little bit ethereal, right? Mm-hmm. That it's not only the look of those pictures that give the idea that this is a bunch of old black blues musicians who are going to be dead in 10 years kind of thing. It gives that extra meaning, but it's also ethereal in the sense that, like, as you were saying, you have to process, you have to develop right there, that, like, this is made in the moment, and there's some value to that as far as how it relates to the subject, which is these people who are here now who won't be here tomorrow, you know?
Yeah.
So there's inherent meaning.
Sure.
Yeah.
There's an inherent material cost.
Yeah, true.
You know, I mean, look at the stuff that Ian Rutter does, those giant tintypes, you know, that's $300-$400 every time he clicks the shutter release. Yeah.
You got to mean it. You got to want it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's do you think that, I mean, okay, there's a thing. You could make platinum prints now where you get for those of you who don't know, you basically get this platinum drops and you build a solution and you sort of paint a piece of paper with the solution. You stick a negative on top and you stick it under a light box and then you process it like you would in a dark room through developer and stop and fix.
It's basically a contact print though.
Yeah, exactly. It's a contact print. That it costs money inherently because the heavy metals used in the platinum or palladium or whatever it is cost a lot of money per ounce, right? And actually the amount that it costs you to make this stuff, if you buy an ounce of this of drops of this chemical, it may cost you $250 for a bottle of this little tiny bottle of platinum drops or whatever, right? There is a certain level of economic exclusivity to certain formats.
Sure. In the same way that if there is a choice between an inkjet print, let's say, and a wet chemical, you know, darkroom print, the darkroom print is often perceived as having more value.
Right. Yeah. But I had lunch yesterday with our photographer of the week this week, and she was telling me that she used some new, not new, but some Fuji 1600 speed color film. But the only place she could find it was like the Lomo store. So it was really expensive. It was like $50 for three rolls or some ridiculous thing,
right,
you know?
Right, right.
And it's just, you know, it's even that. It's just like, well, you know what? She can go do that or chooses to go do that and spend that much money on the thing. But like for me, being able to take whatever 36 shots for, you know, $20 or whatever it is for the roll of film plus processing plus whatever it is, like that becomes economically unsuitable for my purposes, you know,
and for most people.
Yeah. I mean, she's doing something very special that requires that in her look, you know, that kind of look that you get from this stuff. But yeah, I don't know. It's interesting that certain things come with meaning built in. There's a, where do we get, where did you get this Leica article? Cause you put it in there, right?
I don't remember where I saw it.
This is on casualphotofile.com. What is this guy's name? Just so I get it right. Is there a name here? Anyway, the article is called 6 months with the M2 and my struggles with the myth of Leica. And this guy got himself an old 1957 M2 camera and goes on about how, you know, he used it and he didn't find it that magical. And then he kind of relaxed into it and he thought it was really neat. But that ultimately he still likes his, what was it? It was an F3 or an F2 Leica or Nikon rather.
Nikon. Yeah.
One thing I will nitpick just a little bit. You're comparing a camera from 1957 to a camera from 1980. You know, like, how about you compare, you know, it's annoying because the M2, you had to actually twist this thing to rewind the film, and that's kind of awkward, this like stem that pops up, and you had to load the film onto a reel on the other side by hand, and it was kind of a pain in the neck. All of these things were improved upon and sort of fixed in later revisions. The M4 that I own, for example, you just pull the film across like any other one, you know, and just kind of get it close, and it starts it loads up automatically, and it's got a little crank, you know, so it fixes that problem. So some ways he's comparing apples to oranges. He's like, you know, this car from the 1930s doesn't drive as fast as my Porsche from 82, you know.
I don't agree.
You don't agree?
No. I think, okay, because he's talking about, for me, it is this overall mythos that is attached to shooting with Leica.
Oh, I don't think that there's anything special about the pictures you're going to get out of a Leica other than the fact that if you like shooting with it or you don't like shooting with it.
But many Leica users do.
Think that there's something mythical about it.
They insist that this picture only could have happened with a Leica. Yeah.
Well, I disagree with those people. So you and I are in agreement on that. But go ahead.
Yeah. No, that's all I was pointing out. Yeah. It's the idea that, and again, if this goes back a few weeks to what we were talking about, attachment to tools or even spaces for creating, I'm fine if you think that you shoot better with a Leica than a Nikon or a Canon to a Pentax, whatever it is.
Right.
But it's just a machine. It's just a box.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Does it have a great shutter sound? Sure.
Yeah. I guess my point is that there were technical things that he was annoyed by, that he found impractical, that are not true of modern Leicas. You know what I mean? It's just that he's using a very old one that complicates things a little bit. Beyond that, him just going around taking pictures. Have you done that? Have you ever gotten a camera that you felt, okay, you just got that Yashica Matte again? Right.
Yep, 124.
What, about
yep.
a year ago?
Yeah, a little less, but yeah.
And you had that camera as a young man.
Uh-huh.
Correct? Yeah. Wait, where'd your original one go? I don't think you ever said
it. It wasn't ever given to me. It was my grandfather's. He would let me borrow it whenever I wanted to, but it was never given to me.
Where did that
he
go
had that, after that? You know what? That's a good question. I'll have to ask Linda. She may have all of that stuff in boxes somewhere.
Sitting in a box not being used.
Yeah, because he had the 124. He also had a twin lens Rolly.
Sure.
And then he had a 4x5. I think he had a Graflex. That's what it was. Or yeah, I think it's what it was. I'm not sure. I don't know which model. Or
they
Crown
were just
Graphic
sitting
or something.
In a box somewhere not being used, you know.
Right. Anyway,
but,
go ahead.
But just that, when you got that camera back, before you started putting film through it, was there a little of the feeling that we're talking about where you're just like, oh, this is that magic thing that I used as a kid, and here it is again?
I don't know. I was apprehensive about it because, you know, it's sort of like going back to some place that was magical. Disneyland.
Kissing an old girlfriend. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, or that. When you're a child, Disneyland is this enormous place, and it's wonderful, and it's fantastic, and it's magical, and I'm a huge Disney fan, or was a huge Disney fan, but when I went as an adult, then you start noticing the chipping paint, and well, it's not that big from one end to the other, and it's, well, right. I mean, there's this, and then, oh, that's just a, you know what I mean? So
it's not abstractly big, yeah.
Yeah, the luster sort of dulls over time.
Yeah.
And I was curious if that was going to happen with the 124, and it took a little while to get used to it because your directions are kind of backwards. Does it give me any better pictures than any other camera?
Right.
I don't think so.
Right.
The approach is different, and I think that's what we often mistake for the special sauce or the magic of the hardware is the approach that it either forces upon us or allows us to pursue.
I think that is one of the arguments for rangefinders like the Leica, where you can actually see what's coming in and out of the frame as it's moving. Mm-hmm. There were practical reasons why this was the chosen camera of street photographers, 70 years ago.
Sure.
Some of them are that it was one of the only cameras at that level 70 years ago, and it was built like a brick house, and it was unbreakable, and it was a rangefinder, so you could do things like watch the frame line and move the frame line around in a way that you could still see outside the frame right before you took the picture. You could anticipate stuff coming in and out, that kind of thing.
And I really like.
Right. And I think, and in fact, that's one of the things that gets lost on using an EVF in something like your X-Pro,
mm-hmm.
right? Because it crops down to the sensor. So you lose, because when you're an optical, you do get the frame line, right?
Yes, you do.
Yeah. All right. So there's, although, on my little X100S, the frame line shifted with the focus to account for the parallax. Does that make sense?
Does it the same thing.
Okay. All right. Yeah.
There is a corrected AF frame option in preferences.
So you can turn that off.
Yeah. And you can turn it off.
Yeah. For those of you who don't know, when you've got the frame lines in a rangefinder, if you're focused to something really close, the picture that actually gets taken might be off shifted left to right from what you see the box in the frame lines in the viewfinder. So these modern ones can compensate for that to tell you exactly what you're going to get.
Yep.
But which is kind of funny, Jeffrey, to think that all these years that people talk about, oh, these people knew exactly what was going to be in their frame. No, they didn't.
They had a good idea.
Yeah, they were like, okay, yeah, it's probably that thing like halfway in and out, but maybe it's just sitting there, you know. But there are these stories about these cameras. Somebody sent it. God, who sent in this, the Hasselblad thing? It was somebody, it was on Twitter somewhere. I'll find it.
Yeah, I think it was on Twitter. This is a pretty cool story.
This story is amazing.
I do not follow Zach, but this was a pretty cool story. Why don't you set this up?
So this is an article on Deadpixel, so DEDPXL.com, called A Dumb Button. We'll put a link in the show notes, of course. From last week, about a guy and his wife, basically. And they're both photographers, I guess, and there was a running joke between the two of them of what she wanted for her birthday, and every year she would say Hasselblad, but they didn't have the money to buy a Hasselblad, so it was just this running joke of, hey, what do you want for your birthday, Jeffrey? You know.
Specifically the CM, apparently.
A 500 CM, sure.
Yep.
Yeah. And they said, that's a camera. You know, it's a Rolls Royce of cameras, sent shivers down their spine. You know, it's a Hasselblad, right?
Right.
All of this inherent stuff that you and I, people of our age, think about
fawn over.
Yeah, right.
When it comes to cameras design. Yeah.
And they couldn't own one. And sometime in 2007, he walked into his local camera shop, and which had been there forever, for generations. And this other guy walks in and...
Can I just interject one thing?
Yep.
I love the way he writes this particular...
Oh, he writes this great. I'm not going to do it justice. Do you want
to
read
generations,
it?
No, just this one thing.
Yeah.
Three generations own this shop, a downtown staple. The owner knew everyone that walked in. He chatted everybody up. He knew everyone's stories.
Yeah.
That's a really great setup for what comes next.
It is, and... Sad that I'm sure the place is out of business, right?
Oh, yeah, it is. It is out of business.
So that's really sad, yeah. So the guy introduces Sid to this guy, John, who walked in. And John actually works on Hasselblad cameras, this new guy, John, in the story. And he said, look, I've got parts sitting around my house. I'm about to retire. Maybe I can throw together a camera for your wife. I heard the story.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, come back in a couple days. So they came back in a couple days, and this guy brought in a put together, like, perfect Hasselblad. The guy picks it up, you know, takes a picture, it goes clunk, you know, does the Hasselblad thing. And he's just like, I can't afford this or whatever it is. And the guy says, you know, I imagine him saying $1,200, $1,000, whatever. And the guy's like, give me a couple hundred bucks and it's yours. And the guy was like, what?
Yeah.
So he buys the camera from the guy and he takes it home. And he says, you know, if you come back in a couple of days, I might have another finder for you and this, that, and the other thing. And the owner of the camera store, do you know who that guy is? And his name is John Kovacs. And apparently John Kovacs was one of the original group of technicians that worked with NASA on modifying Hasselblads for the space program.
Yeah. Yeah. The owner tells Sid, go home and look him up.
Yeah. Go look him up. Right. Go Google this guy. And then apparently he came back and he's like, hey, I started asking me questions. I found all the stuff on you online. He goes, yeah, that's me. He said with slight irritation. I love that. It's so cool. He says, space effing Armstrong couldn't operate the camera with his stupid big moon gloves on. So I had to create a big dumb button that he could bang on to take exposure.
Yeah.
That's so excellent.
It's great.
It was one of the most surreal moments I've ever been part of, listening to someone irritated about the part they played in documenting people landing on the moon. Apparently, there's a whole documentary film on this angry statement. Have you found that?
No.
I got to find that. So him and his wife started just taking pictures with this Hasselblad, and they loved it. And, you know, John lived until 2013. He had moved to Florida, and he passed away. But, like, it's, you know, it's one of these guys. I mean, talk about a camera with a story. Right.
Yeah, sure. Sure.
I mean, this is one of those things where it's like, I have a Hasselblad that was basically put together by a guy who worked on the ones that went to the moon, right? This is a technician of highest order.
Yeah. That's like having you know, Les Paul wind the coils on your guitar or something.
Exactly. Yeah. But you know, all these cameras and things that you and I are telling these stories about. I had a thing in the show notes. I know you removed it, but I think it's just a little bit germane to our topic. Is apparently guitars. No one's buying guitars anymore, and all these guitar businesses are going out of business.
Oh, I thought we talked about it.
Oh, that's did why we talk about it? Oh,
I thought we did.
It was brand new from Washington Post this week.
Oh, whoops.
Okay.
Oh, you know why I took it out? Because Washington Post has a paywall, so people can't see it.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, yeah, I was just looking at it with the what's it called? Turned on incognito mode, and then you can read it. But apparently, you know, Fender and Gibson and all these companies are kind of sucking wind right now, right? And Paul Reed Smith. And the theory is that there aren't heroes anymore, guitar heroes, and people aren't buying guitar. Your average person's not buying a guitar. When you and I were in college, half the people on the floor had a Strat or a Les
Paul
or some sort of guitar.
Yeah, or Tele. Yeah,
right.
Something.
Yeah.
Yep.
And so there was this thing because they were in love with, you know, Clapton or... Yeah.
And there were a dozen guys that you could point to go, I want to be that.
Exactly, right? And to be that, you have to have that guitar. The people who were actually playing music weren't enough to sustain these companies, right?
Right.
You know, it was people buying these things to clomp around in their dorm room. And this was like the way it was. And I'm wondering if and then what happened, Jeffrey, is that the price of these old guitars went through the roof in the last 20 years or whatever it is, because it was all these young people back in the day, like you and me, who at 40 suddenly had a few bucks in our pocket and decided I'm going to go buy that $4,000 three pickup Les Paul that I always wanted, right?
Or that limited edition Martin that, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But the problem is we've all done that and young kids aren't interested in guitars.
Right.
And so the guitar industry is doing this thing. So, you know, you and I right now, I bet you if we did you remember when you did that survey of our listeners? Did you ask for average age? Did you ever figure that out?
Yes, but that was, you know.
Yeah, 154 episodes ago.
4 years ago, 5 years ago.
Right. But what was the average age? Like our age?
I don't remember, but it was not 18 to 24.
You're right. And so the people listening to this show are hearing us talk about a Hasselblad or a Leica, and half of them, I'm guessing, are going, yeah, I want a Hasselblad or a Leica.
Right.
I always wanted one of those, but I don't know that the...
Meanwhile, Alan Bailward is still like, stupid Hasselblad or Leica, get a Pentax.
Exactly. And at the moment, he's right. But there is some level of the kids don't care about that anymore. Right. Are there photographic heroes for the next generation that are using these tools that we're talking about?
Are all sure the next there are.
Right, but sure are all the next
it's
generation?
What drives the gear industry.
Right, right. But I think there's less than there used to be, is my point.
Probably.
You know, and that's why the sales of all these things are going down the way they are, et cetera, et cetera. I think the camera industry is a good correlation, has a good correlation to the electric guitar industry in some ways.
You know who's got a monster collection of electric guitars?
Wait, is this a famous person or not famous person?
It's a famous person.
Monster collection of electric guitars. Somebody who's not a musician.
And it's not Rick Nielsen from Cheap Trick, although he has a monster collection too.
I don't know. Who are you coming
Steven
up with?
Steven Seagal.
Really?
Steven Seagal. Hundreds of guitars.
Really?
Yeah.
I wonder what Steven Seagal's doing with 100 guitars.
Well, he's considers himself a serious player.
Oh, is he a serious? He was a musician for a while, right? He would like do blues or whatever.
I guess. I don't know. But he's got some famous people. He's got one of Hendrix's guitars. He's got one of Albert Collins' guitars.
Yeah,
a bunch of B.B. King's guitars.
You know, interestingly enough, also in that article, they were talking about how Gibson spent millions of dollars coming up with a self-tuning guitar. Did you know this existed?
No.
Apparently some kind of crazy motorized system, right? Where like the headstock had motors in it.
Really?
That's what I'm guessing. Or maybe it was down in the bridge. Anyway.
Was it constantly listening to itself or something and adjusting?
Yeah, I got to look it up. Auto-tune guitar. And apparently it was like this giant flop because...
Wow. So they decided to start doing auto-tune for voice.
Yeah. No, but they had this guitar that would tune itself and they spent all this money. It's a robot tuner. Yeah. Mini tune. And it would automatically tune your guitar. Now, apparently...
Drop a link into Skype. Yeah,
they apparently made this thing and it wasn't very successful, right? Like it didn't... No one wanted it, right? And part of the reason why no one wanted it was because tuning is not that big of a problem. And in some ways, that's part of the skill of being a guitarist is being able to tune your instrument, right?
I think so. You were a poser if you had one of these.
Yeah, maybe, right?
Oh, wow, look at this thing. Huh. Right.
It's just a little box that goes on the back of the neck and sort of rotates the tuners, I guess. Weird, right?
Huh.
Now, yeah. Gibson, someone at Gibson, Jeffrey, thought that this was a problem that needed solving, and this is the reason why they weren't selling guitars, because they were too hard to tune, you know?
Hmm.
I wonder if there's somebody at Canon or Nikon right now who's saying, you know why people don't buy our fancy cameras anymore? It's because X is too hard, you know?
Yeah, but what's left? I mean, cameras have gotten so good at... I mean, although they still struggle with two different colored lights in a scene.
Yeah, but you know what? Computational photography, these are places where in some ways things like the iPhone are actually better than bigger cameras, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
In the sense that, you know, the iPhone will... Gary Yost, friend of the show, Gary Yost, took some pictures with his iPhone 7 on a recent trip. It's like all he brought with him. And they were great. I'll find a link and put them in the show notes. And they were really, really good. And it's kind of like...
Gary's got pretty mad skills, though.
No,
I mean, Gary knows what he's doing.
Yeah, no, Gary's fantastic. But you know, it is interesting. You look at these pictures and you wouldn't necessarily say, oh, yeah, those were totally taken with the phone. It's just like, they're lovely. They're beautiful, you know? And so you kind of got to wonder... what's left, right?
Right.
You know, could you put those skills into a bigger camera so you have a better sensor and blah, blah, blah? So, you know what I mean? Because there are limitations to what the thing can do.
Mm-hmm.
But put those skills into a big camera so it can figure out to lower the sky level a little bit so it's not so blown out. You know, taking multiple exposures on the sensor and merging them to create an HDR-y kind of thing, not a bad HDR, but sort of an expanded dynamic range kind of thing in camera, and to tone it all automatically and to give you a JPEG out of the camera that looks like I spent 45 minutes on curves adjustment layers in Photoshop. Yeah, that's totally doable.
That's, yeah. Well, apparently, this was just on, I think, Photo Rumors. Yeah. Sony announced a new 10 megapixel four-thirds sensor with instant HDR. And if you look at, I'll drop this into Skype, maybe put it in the show notes if you want.
Yep.
But look at the left and the right. Yeah, it's only a 10 megapixel image at the moment, but look at the difference between the two.
Yeah.
And it's doing instant multiple exposures and what you just suggested, then spitting out this, you know, relative to using, you know, not using it, a lovely JPEG.
Right. And so, I mean, you know, I took, I don't know, over like 1,200 pictures over three shoots, which is a lot for me in the last, you know, when I was away last week. Mm-hmm. And I came back and I culled them down and I worked on them. And like, I had to send stuff over to the magazine yesterday and I pulled up some of my favorites and sort of processed them the way that I would imagine the finals would be processed, just to give them some idea of where the, you know, the raw selects sort of could go.
This
is
what it could look like.
Yeah. Like, yeah, this is what I'm imagining these are going to look like. So choose based upon what the guy looks like, not like how the thing is toned right now, that kind of thing.
Right.
And, you know, I took three hours doing, I don't know, 10, 12 pictures. You know what I mean? Just kind of like messing around and playing with them. Could they have looked just as good with some sort of computer making a lot of those decisions? Well, they would have looked way better than they did right out of camera. I had to do the work on my camera, you know, do I want them to take that power or craft away from me? No, I enjoy that part of it. So I don't want to do that.
Well, I think there will always be that space, you know.
Sure.
Yes, auto tone in Lightroom is better now than it was 5 years ago.
Actually, man, I haven't done that. Have you done that recently? Like, just clicked
it? I look at it. Yeah. I look at all the auto toning and you know, different types of presets that come out. But, you know,
is it true that it's better than it was? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I haven't played it. But
actually, let me back up. It could be that, you know how on the bottom right where you have the
reset and the previous, that kind of thing?
No. The processing style, like every couple years they come up with.
Oh, yeah.
That could be the change, not necessarily the toning.
Sure, that the raw engine is better than the old.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. Exactly. Yep.
Okay, got it.
But there are still these decisions. I was at the Smithsonian over the weekend, or Friday, I guess it was, and I was talking to Hugh. And he was showing me some interiors that he had shot for the museum. And every single one of them, not only was it multiple exposures stitched together, but every single one has multiple layer masks, and he's color correcting things individually, and they're flagging things and shooting and then filling and shooting and then stitching and combining. So yes, the computational side of photography can get better for certain situations, but I don't see a day anytime soon where the aesthetic and judgment and knowledge of the photographer gets thrown out with the bathwater.
No, but you know, I mean, okay, so Hugh is a serious photographer, also been taking pictures for, you know, probably longer than you and I combined, right?
He's been, I think he started at Archives 45 years ago.
Yeah.
Went to RISD, you know, so he's serious.
Yeah, I spent some time with listener Tim Sharp last week on one of my shoots, and he was showing me some of his interior stuff, and you know, he's taking multiple exposures to get the outside of the room and to get the white balance right and to do this and to do that, you know, interior work.
And it's not like, because necessarily he digs it. He might dig it, but it's because you have to do it to get the shot right.
The thing is, I don't know, man, like maybe you bring an iPhone in there and you click go and see what it does. Maybe it does a really good job, you know, taming all of that stuff in a way that our fancy cameras don't, you know. I'm not saying that Hugh and Tim are wrong in what they're doing. It's how I would do it. But like, I also haven't tried whatever the new super gizmo is that does this supposedly as good as me. Maybe it's getting good enough that it will put our skills out of business. I don't know. It makes me nervous to think that it does, or that it will be good enough, right? Which is the other big thing. Maybe it's not as good, but it's good enough.
Right.
And that's almost even scarier, because then the market.
Well, good enough is a moving target.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
And it shifts generationally. It shifts with decades. It shifts with what kind of gear is available. It is keeping up with good enough is really hard to do.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, look, my camera at 52 megapixels or whatever it is. What were we talking about? Some guy who's shooting with the 100 now, and he's, oh, finally, this is enough resolution. You know, remember we were talking about that? And it's a little bit like that, right? It's like the idea that anyone would have a 50 megapixel camera 10 years ago. It's like, no one had those.
That either Phase or Hasselblad or Fuji or all three are going to come out with a 150 megapixel camera within the next 2 years.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah. Or at least everyone will start using the 100 megapixel sensor in the Fuji and my camera and whatever it is, right? And I'll get that camera at some point, and I'll take a picture with it, and I'll stick it next to my picture from my 50 and go, oh my God, how did I ever live with so few pixels as 50 megapixels, right?
Sure.
Even though today, pictures I took last week, I could crop in to, you know, a eighth of the picture or a tenth of the picture, and it would still be a fine double truck on a magazine, you know, double picture.
Sure.
Right. Because we've gotten to that point.
Your 5D was a fine double truck.
I mean, I could crop the hell out of it and still have a double truck is my point. You know, like, and that's what kills me is that I've already got more than I could possibly have, and I can't imagine needing more. But the minute you show me more, that's when I think I need more.
Yeah.
You know, I need more acceleration.
And then the minute you have more, you find all sorts of justifications for reasons why you had to do it and why what you had before wasn't good enough.
Yeah.
It was good enough.
Right. But some of that might be, this is what my clients expect, even if I don't think that I need it. I mean, it gets back to that whole like showboating thing, right? I don't like that whole world, but that's a reality in some places.
Oh, yes, you do. Yes, you do.
Oh, I don't. You kidding me? I use Paul Buff lights, man. I don't got no brown color.
Nice.
Pro photo. Fancy ass stuff. It's a whole thing. Who put up this British Journal of Photography article? I think you put this one in, right?
The guy
out in the American West.
Yeah, yeah. Partially, I don't know how to pronounce Brian's last name. Is it Schutmat?
Schutmat. Yeah, probably.
I think it is. I have followed him for a long time, and I love his work. There is a book that he did. I think it was in 2012 or something around there, called Gray the Mountain Sends, or Gray's the Mountain Sends, something like that.
Gray's the Mountain Sends, yes.
I remember wanting a copy of that because I thought it looked beautiful. But it's another one of those things where it was a limited run and...
Yeah, there were 12 of them.
Yeah, it became, you know, kind of the it book to have at the time that it was released, and now you know they're selling for thousands of dollars on the secondary market.
Sure.
Let me see. There was a.
Okay, did you, by the way, if you scroll down in this article, that the second picture of the pit mine, with the roads going down, you know, you see that one?
Let me get there. 1 second. Yes.
Okay. Would you ever drive down that road?
No. I would have to be very cautious just walking down that road because I know me.
Yeah. Right. I just imagine driving down even in a big truck and you hit one of those icy patches and you just go right over the side.
Yeah.
Anyway, go ahead.
He does have another book called Islands of the Blessed.
Oh, okay.
Well, that's what we are. And the second edition of that is $35, looks like.
Okay. Well, so I'll go find those and put some links in the show notes. But
beautiful work. Anyway, go ahead.
Oh, so this guy went out to, where is he from? Germany? Is he actually British? Let's see. Oh, Texas born. No, he's American. Sorry.
Yeah.
Went out and shot a bunch of portraits and all kinds of stuff for, large format, I guess is what he, 4x5 or 8x10. Let me see. I couldn't tell from this. I found it somewhere in here.
4x5.
Is it 4x5? Okay.
Yeah.
And he was just saying, you know, he just put his digital camera aside. He shot film, slowed down, you know, got the tonalities that he says are only available in film and all the things that we, you know, people talk about.
I mean, look at the shot of the guy in the truck.
Oh yeah, it's lovely. Yeah,
it's absolutely, it's brilliant. I mean, it's one of those things where you can feel this guy. You know where he's from. You know who he is. You know what his life has been like. You can see the rest of that truck, even though we only see the cab.
You only know because it's you.
Come on.
No. Yeah. No. What were we gonna say? No. Totally. Yeah. Yeah. And you know, I would, however, like to see what this negative looked like. You know,
mm-hmm.
how much manipulation does he do after scanning to get them to look like this? You know, because it's always a question whenever anybody talks about the magic of film. It's like, well, if you're still doing a lot of manipulation, you could shoot this with a, you know, a smaller camera and probably get something fairly similar if you toned it, right? But the question is that in, you know, I said to the Lily yesterday, I said, you know, at the point at which there are only three films available because everything else goes out of business, one of the big advantages of shooting film, which is that you could choose your tonality by buying a different film, right? I like this look of this particular film, which is why I shoot with it. But now when there's only three or four films left, because they stopped making Ektachrome for medium format and they stopped making all this kind of stuff, the advantages of film get lessened by the fact that you're limited to only a few different feels, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I mean,
just as
beautiful.
A point of fact, yeah. I did find the article on Faded and Blurred that I did about him from 2013.
Oh, give me the thing. I'll put
and
it.
It's here.
Okay. Cool.
Lately, I've been coming across more and more photography that just stops me in my tracks. I can't decide if there's just more great work out there or that I'm being much more conscious and deliberate in my ongoing search for great photographs to inspire me. Either way, the work of photographer Brian Shootmat is absolutely superb. The portraits in his latest series called Graze the Mountain Sends are at once heartbreaking and mesmerizing. Shot on large format film, blah, 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 blah. So anyway, yeah, that's where I first saw his work, and I've been kind of a fan of his ever since.
Oh, yeah, some of these, most of these same ones, so this must be not necessarily brand new work.
No, it's from a while ago. It's from that first book.
Yeah, it's interesting, man. I don't know where the world's going. If it's going backwards, if it's going forwards, if it's going sideways when it comes to photography and equipment and technology, you know? It's like this guy's
there will always be a place for it, I think.
Yeah.
For film. And as long as people are still making it anyway.
Well, that's, yeah. And then the question of the economics of that. And, you know, the less they make, the more expensive it gets, the less people use it. So it's sort of a little bit of a death spiral, right?
Mm-hmm.
To use the political term. Yeah, it's,
I thought, yeah, go ahead.
What death, panels? Is that what the one you're looking
yeah,
for?
Yeah, it's a death panels. That's what, yeah.
Well, there's also the idea that the markets go in a death spiral, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I like the, mm-hmm. 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 Jeffrey, let's talk about our sponsor today.
Let's see. Is it? Oh, you know who'd be a good sponsor?
Who should we get?
Entenmann's.
Oh, man. You know what? I could go for an entire box of Entenmann little... the powdered sugar donuts? Donettes?
Entenmann's. Oh. If you're listening, Entenmann's, let's talk.
You think that ever works?
No. No.
What if there's... Okay, but here's the thing. We got thousands of listeners. What if one of them actually works for Entenmann's and could send us boxes full of donuts?
Then we would be happy and speak to their greatness for years to come.
Seriously, dude, call us. this week's episode is brought to you by FreshBooks.com. Did you like that little thing?
Little vibrato. It was almost a little Ethel Merman.
Jeffrey, what if you could reclaim 192 hours a month of your precious time? Would you do that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, our friends at FreshBooks, who make it ridiculously easy cloud accounting software for freelancers are architects behind this question, and for good reason. By bypassing tasks like invoicing, tracking expenses, and getting paid online, FreshBooks has drastically reduced the time it takes for over 10 million people to deal with their work paperwork. Man, invoicing really is like the worst thing ever. In fact, I got to do some invoicing this afternoon.
Who? Roman Mars.
Roman Mars uses it.
Yeah.
In beautiful downtown Oakland, California. That was my Roman Mars impression. Can
read
you do
the
a better one?
No, I don't. I can't do Roman Mars. He's got one of those voices. Same with the guy that does Snap Judgment.
Oh yeah, Glenn.
I can't do that either.
Yeah,
because he's just excited all the time.
You know, Roman Mars used to work for Snap Judgment.
Yeah, I do know that.
By simplifying, if that's not enough incentive, FreshBooks platform has been rebuilt from the ground up, Jeffrey. They've taken simplicity and speed to an entirely new level. Added powerful.
I'm just
going to
do
features.
That. It's going to be like a gospel thing. I'm just going to call it out. New level.
And if you're doing the math, Jeffrey,
testify.
192 work hours works out to 2 working days per month that you're not going to be doing paperwork.
You ready for it? Here it is. Here it is.
Yeah.
Mm.
If you're listening to this and you're not using FreshBooks yet, now would be the time to try it. FreshBooks is offering an unrestricted 30-day free trial for all our listeners.
Free trial.
No credit card required.
Mm-mm.
All you have to do is go to freshbooks.com/ontakingpictures.
Clickety, clickety, click.
And enter on taking pictures in the how did you hear from us section. And you're going to get your free 30-day trial. They've got quick, easy invoicing. You can send clean, professional-looking invoices in about 30 seconds. You can get online payments with literally 2 clicks. You can set yourself up to receive payments online. Mobile expenses. So you got an app on your phone. You take pictures of your receipts, and you could stick them into certain invoices. Perfect. Send them to your client. Get reimbursed. You got these projects features, so you could share files and messages with your clients, contractors, and employees. And you can see how quickly things happen when everything lives in one place. You got Notification Center. It's like a personal assistant. It'll let you know what's changed in your business since you last logged on. Who
helping
paid,
you out.
Who looked at their invoice. I like that one. That was good. And when your client, Jeffrey, looks at the email invoice, FreshBooks will let you know. So they can't do that whole, yeah, I'm sorry, I didn't get your invoice.
Have mercy.
Multi-currency. So if you're working in other countries, you can get paid in euros. Or,
euros, please.
Yeah. And of course, they will answer the phone usually in less than 3 rings. Award-winning customer service. Amazingly helpful. They got automated late payment reminders for people who don't want to pay you. So you need to go check them out. Try FreshBooks free for 30 days. Go to freshbooks.com/ontakingpictures. Enter ontakingpictures in the how did you hear from us section. Thank you so much for FreshBooks for supporting our show.
And it was good.
Okay, that's weird.
Yeah.
Hey, Tom in Michigan sent us this morning.
Tom in Michigan.
There's a neighborhood in LA, Boyle Heights.
Boyle Heights.
Where's Boyle Heights?
Boyle Heights is downtown. You know where the 110 freeway is?
Sure.
It would be to the, let's see, northwest of Boyle Heights? I mean, of downtown?
Here, okay.
Hold on a sec. Let me make sure I'm getting south, my right.
So near, isn't Dodger Stadium near there?
Hold on one sec.
Jeffrey's educating himself.
I'm re-educating myself. Yes.
LA has a whole lot of neighborhoods.
Yes.
Too yes. many. Too many neighborhoods.
Yeah. Too much. Too hot in the hot tub.
Yeah. Oh, I see. Okay.
Okay. Boils. So. My mistake. It's to the east, not to the west.
Oh, okay. Oh, I see. Oh, it's right over the river.
Yeah, LA River on the other side of the LA River.
Okay. Now, so this was a what, Latino area?
Predominantly Latino. Okay. Yeah.
And relatively poor. I mean, this was like
a lot of the money went into the gentrification of downtown. because it's closer to like the Disney Concert Hall and City Hall. Yeah. And, you know, so Boyle Heights is one of those neighborhoods that has remained largely unchanged for decades.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Terrific food, though. Terrific restaurants.
Apparently, a bunch of galleries have opened up on Anderson Street, which I'm assuming is like the high street, the main street there. And the locals are, some of the locals are not having it because they see this as like the first step of some sort of gentrification that will push them out of their own neighborhood.
Which they're probably not too far off.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But there's also, I mean, a larger question of the inevitability of so-called gentrification, right? You know, as one person points out, all of those things increase the cost and value of the local neighborhood. It's like, yes, the cost and the value. So yes, it's more expensive, but if you own stuff there, it'll become more valuable. So, what are you going to do?
But for those who don't own, for those who are renting and get pushed out of those areas, where are they to go? It's one of the last lower cost neighborhoods in the area.
Vanishing
lower cost areas.
Yeah, and you know what? But you get in these weird things, and this is kind of what I wanted to get at, which was that apparently the door of one of the galleries, that people go out and protest these galleries and coffee shops saying, get the hell out of here. We don't want your coffee and hipster this, that, and the other thing. And one of them said, F white art, right? The idea that the art that was in this place wasn't our art, so get it the hell out of here.
I wonder if a Latino gallery opened up that featured predominantly Latino artists
or local artists,
or even like a throwback to the sort of Chicano art movement that happened like 60s and 70s.
Right. This is my point and my question. Okay. Is art an economic thing? Is it invasive? Right. Is it, we're coming in and we're bringing our art. Is art of a certain people?
I think it can be, sure.
Yeah.
I think it can be seen as an exploitation of a people or a culture or a movement that can be sort of usurped by another people or movement.
But in this case, this would be, I'm simplifying it, white artists making quote unquote European art, right? So no one's being seized upon, you know. It's just sort of like, I'm bringing the art that I make into your neighborhood, which is generally not populated by people who make this kind of art. Is that a weird, like, racist thing right there, though? It's strange, right? It's interesting, the idea that we don't want your art in here. Couldn't there be some value in people seeing each other's work and art? Is art,
sure, there could, but not at the expense of culture. At the expense of culture.
Yeah, but who makes those decisions?
I would imagine, in this case, at least the residents are deciding, look, we don't want this here.
Yeah, but is that how that works, though? I mean, if it was a different racial person moving into the neighborhood just with a house, could they say, we don't want you here because you're orange? You know?
Didn't 56% of the people say that?
You know what I'm saying, though, right?
I couldn't resist. I get what you're saying.
It's interesting that there's this assumption that art is evil or invasive or trying to mix things up, when it's really none of those things. Like, that label is being put on it. Each one of these gallery owners is just trying to find a place to open their gallery that they can afford the rent, right? You know, it's not this insidious person behind the thing pulling the strings of the puppets of the people trying to gentrify the area.
Maybe, but that's the way it's seen.
Yeah.
And if people in this area, or any area, frankly, are struggling to make ends meet, and they walk by this shop that has a few swirls of paint on it, for $20,000, and they're trying to keep their kids in diapers or to keep food on the table or to keep shoes on their feet. Well, yeah, I can see where that would be, you know, kind of picking at the scab.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's interesting.
Absolutely.
Yesterday, there was an article in the New York Times, I'll put in the show notes. It says, art gallery closures grow for small and mid-sized dealers. And apparently, small galleries, at least in New York, Small to medium-sized galleries, their sales have been down about 5-7% last year. Mm-hmm. Ones who sell more than $1 million saw sales rise by 7%. So basically, the same thing that's happening in the economic thing in America, which is the rich get richer, the poor get poorer, or right. the middle class, you know, like there's this split between the upper middle class and rich people where it's dividing in two directions. Mm-hmm. The same thing seems to be happening in the art market. And I met somebody the other day who works for a gallery, and they were telling me that, you know, they're going out and they're making cold calls because that's how you get business nowadays, because not enough people come in. You get lists of people who buy art, and you basically cold call them and figure out what they're trying to get. And they're not selling new artists. The stuff that they end up selling, even though they have new artists on the walls, what they end up selling, if it's photography, is Ouija and mm-hmm. Bresson Irwitt. And
yeah.
Irwitt,
Abaddon.
Right?
Yeah.
Right. People don't want to buy my stuff or, you know, modern people's stuff. They want to buy the old stuff because that has some sort of intrinsic value. And part of that has to do with the fact that so much money has moved into the art market as some sort of liquid assets.
Mm-hmm. Those are the blue chip stocks.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's interesting. It's like no one puts their money down or fewer people put their money down on living working artists. So many of them, it's like, oh, is he or she dead? Great. Then that's right. more valuable.
And I don't know. I mean, I just ordered a Fiden has a book sale going on. And if you are listening to this and you're interested, their book sale, I think it ends on Friday, and there are some terrific deals to be had. Fiden.com, Phaidon.
Did we talk about that last week?
Yeah, it's still going on.
Okay.
So I ordered two books that I'm really interested in. One is on Alexei Brodovich, famously the art director who worked with Avedon at Harper's, but also a book on pop art. Because I really don't understand what makes something valuable or important. I know to a degree what I like and don't like, but I don't know why something should or shouldn't be important. And I want to learn more about it. So I've been talking to more people down here. I've been talking to more people in the museum world. And I ordered this book. It's kind of a survey of pop art, both in America and in the UK, since the 1960s,
okay.
in an effort to help me understand why these things are important and maybe some of the thought processes behind them.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons I bring this up is we went to the Hirshhorn to see the Infinity mirrors, the Kusama Infinity mirrors. And I'll be honest with you, I didn't get it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this was the hot ticket. This exhibit was by far the most popular exhibit that the Hirshhorn has mounted in years.
Yeah.
I mean, hundreds of thousands. You couldn't get tickets to this thing.
Yep.
And I just went, huh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I remember having an infinity mirror on my wall in junior high with the mirror and the little lights around it. So it looked like they were trailing off into the distance. And it was like, okay, well, that's cool. You got it at Spencer Gifts or whatever. So, but now there's this whole like highbrow art exhibit that's taken it to the nth degree.
Yeah.
And I just don't understand it. I don't understand why it's significant.
How did I get there? Who knows who? Yeah. Yeah,
I don't get it. So well, I, yeah. that's one of my big focuses right now in especially now that the book is winding up is to gain a greater understanding, because we talk about this a lot on this show, and I don't feel like my internal needle of understanding has moved very far. And I right. want to be able to bring something to these conversations other than it's interesting.
Sure.
You
yeah,
know?
Yeah.
Because I don't know. So we'll see where it goes.
Yeah. You're going to have to let us know where you go on that.
Yeah, right.
I'm getting a little tight on time. So why don't we, you want to save this thing for next week?
Yeah, let's save this thing.
Apparently my sister is in Elizabeth, New Jersey, according to my thing.
Ah, okay. So yeah, let's save this.
Let's go to the group or something. Is that all right?
Sorry, Adam West. Rest in peace. The group.
All right, I'm pulling up the assignments.
So the assignment last week,
Sublime,
was Sublime, and there were a couple standouts for me. Nick Govis, The Light on that shot, girl walking up the street, food truck, the light, absolutely right. Beautiful, beautiful.
Would you call it sublime?
I would.
Okay.
I would. It's gorgeous. Also, the other standout for me, and it's probably my favorite of the assignment shots for last week, Stephen Shaw. That is a gorgeous picture. The light on that field of flowers or whatever those are, and I love the silhouette or partial silhouette of the tree line kind of diagonally down the composition, the clouds balancing it out. It's terrific, terrific shot.
Oh, Stephen Shaw. See. Yeah.
Terrific shot.
Interesting.
If you ever do print that, Stephen, I know where you can hang it. I'm just saying.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Yeah, look beautiful at those clouds. Shot.
Yeah, stunning.
Light coming around the corner.
Yeah. What do you
looks,
got?
Looks
what
like else? The zone system, Jeffrey.
That's right, Ansel. All the zones are represented here.
Did you ever actually work with the zone system?
You know, I read his books as in high school when I built my darkroom. Yeah. I was a big Ansel Adams person because of his technical expertise in the darkroom. So sure. I bought, you know, the Capture the Print, all the zone books. Sure. I had probably 10 different Adams books. And I understood it in theory, but in practice, it never really materialized for me.
Yeah, it seems like the kind of just getting exposure correct nowadays. I mean, especially with modern digital cameras, you even have more dynamic range than most of these films. So now it's like less about getting it dead perfect and more about how you want it to look rather than trying to do it with numbers, you know. Mm-hmm, like it's very rare that I think about, I mean, I will say to an assistant or somebody helping me set up lights, say, oh, I want that backlight to stop up from this one or whatever. But it's right. never a, oh, let's but get out a going, meter and say, yeah, oh,
I want this to be zone 8.
I'm at F8 and yeah, this is yeah. at whatever. Right, exactly. You just don't think of that. The Dennis Skyam picture is really beautiful too. The yeah. one up top of Copenhagen.
Beautiful. Yeah. Beautiful. Yeah,
really beautiful. It's a
Benjamin Brown. Terrific shot. Todd Schick. Todd, I consistently love your work. Colors, point of view, and it's just the sort of nostalgia of the vehicles that you tend to find or the settings that you tend to find. Love
we,
your stuff.
We call it POV.
Yes.
Johan Troyer had that beautiful look, FDR, HDR-ish looking thing. A little oversaturated for me. but lovely. I was trying to see if there almost looked like there was a big cat up in the tree. It almost looked like there was some sort of like leopard up in the tree, but it's not. It's just a branch.
Ken Robertson, nice. Yeah.
So I pulled one for this week. You all right with the assignment?
Yeah. One more.
Oh yeah. What do you got?
Marsu Pilami. I hope I'm not butchering your name, Marsu. That's a terrific look. That's really, really nice.
Oh, yeah. Yep. With yeah. the sliced anyway. Print.
So what do you got? But thank you. A lot of terrific stuff. Robert
Fantastic,
Barone.
Yeah. I'm Jeffrey. I like to dance.
I do like to dance. yeah, so some really good stuff. Thank you, guys. Keep them coming. We love seeing these.
Yeah.
Love them, love them, love them. Oh, Florian, nice night shot. I could never get a night shot to work, so I had to go with a diagram in the book. Couldn't get one that I liked.
Yep, it's difficult.
It is. I went out probably a half dozen times trying to get something that I liked, and in the end, it just didn't work.
Yeah. If you want to go...
Wait, what's the assignment?
I was going to say. If you want to go try our assignment this week, #interference interference.
I thought you were jumping to if you want to get a hold of us.
No.
See?
No. I got work
to do. I jumped the gun on you jumping the gun.
we jumped the collective guns.
We're jumping.
#interference interference. We're going to try interference. That this week.
I like that.
Yeah, it's different, right?
Yeah. What's stopping you?
So wrong in so many ways.
Nailed it.
Our photographer of the week is a new friend of mine, Lillian Day Thorpe. Who has her graduate degree in photography and makes what I think are some beautiful nice digital stuff. Compositions.
Yeah, really nice stuff.
Yeah, right?
I'd like to get in her head. It's really interesting work.
So she creates textures, takes a lot of pictures, brings them in, and composes stuff in post from elements that she shoots almost entirely on film.
Mm-hmm. Is she doing the blur in camera, or is she creating the blur in post as well?
I do not know specifically, so that's a question you could ask her if you interview her.
Well, do an email introduction. Let's talk.
We can make that happen. But I think that it's definitely, I mean, it's interesting to me that the colors and tones that she chooses are very much almost like a early 20th century. Is it the Steichen picture of the moon over the lake? You know what I'm talking about? There's a famous, it was like the most expensive picture ever sold or something like that. Print. It's a moonrise, right? Moonlight. Yeah. It's Moonlight the Pond by Steichen, which I will view image, and I will send you a link. Yes, here's a link in show notes, and in Skype, and I'll put it in the show notes too.
Oh, yeah. Okay,
right?
Okay.
It's got that kind of tone,
right? You say
right?
Moonrise. I always think of that Adams picture.
Yeah, it's called Moonlight the Pond. Yeah. You see what I'm saying, though? It's got a similar kind of feel to what Lily's going for here, which is this sort of ethereal, it feels like, history. It feels like it's been worn, that these images are really old and she's just kind of found them, you know,
right.
That these places don't really exist, that kind of thing, which I think is just really, really neat. And
it's almost like they've been taken out and sort of photocopied and scanned and re-photocopied.
And
there's a weathering to
or,
them,
or layers of the stuff that you end up putting on your paintings, you know what I mean, like all etches and stuff. So I think her work is really lovely, and she's a very sweet young woman.
How did you guys hook up?
Funny enough, I was at a restaurant, and I was going to shoot the owner of the restaurant for my portrait of the day. And she's like, "Oh, you know, you shouldn't shoot me." And I was like, "Who's that woman at the? Who's the blonde girl at the bar there? Because it has like a bar." She goes, "Oh, that's Lily. Like, you should definitely shoot her, and you should talk to her. She's a photographer." And we got to talking, and I took her picture last week for 365 Portraits. So you can go find that on my Wadman 365 feed.
Yeah, it's really
feed.
Cool. Stars over a mountain. That's
cool. And we sat down and started talking. And she started showing me her work, and I was like, "Wow, this is really good." And you can buy her prints. They're like $150-$200 and they're beautiful. Check her out. Lillian Day Thorpe.
Yeah. Good choice.
Moon
rose over an open field. That's a terrific shot too.
I will put a link.
Yeah. Really nice. Yeah. I'd love to, if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah. I can make that happen.
That would be cool.
And, with that, I think we need to wrap up for the day. If you want to get a hold of us, 347-687-9411.
Although you might have to wait because Tom
in Michigan might tie up the line.
Right. It's like a party line. Wouldn't that be great? Remember lines?
Yeah, that's kind of cool. No. Do you remember party lines?
Sadly.
Podcast, we never had one, but I do remember. com. Epo Wadman at Jeffrey Sidoris on Twitters and Instagrams. And
you still doing the Facebook, or have you relegated to just Twitter and Instagram?
No, my Twitter,
it auto posts. I know that, but do you still do anything?
I mean, sometimes I honestly haven't had the time lately, and I'll go comment on things that people comment on Facebook, but I don't put things specifically on Facebook. I have a Bill Wadman like photographer thing on Facebook that, you know,
like a page instead of a personal account.
I've got one of those, and I've got a personal account, but my personal account is like a personal account, you know, it's friends and family.
Kind of locked down.
Yeah. So it's, you know, I don't know. I guess there's value to all these things. I just got to dig deeper into that when I have a chance.
Sure.
We will talk to you next week, and we'll come up with some more interesting stuff.
Yeah. We have some stuff already in the notes that we didn't get to. So, and if you've got suggestions, we love hearing from you.
Yep.
You know, we got some terrific stuff from listeners this week. I got a terrific book from a listener. So thank you again, John, for the book. It's stuff that I wrestle with all the time. So, yeah.
Stop wrestling with things.
I wrestle. I'm a wrestler.
Yeah, we'll talk to you next week.
All right, have a good week.
Going on and on the way we are for so long. To any fool, it's plain to see something's wrong. As this way, say what you wanna say. Say, will leave me out.